Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and as we know from Sandy, those folks along the shores have reason to be particularly concerned about the start of hurricane season, which just began this weekend, and they're predicting a bad season. But those folks are not the only ones. Eric Kleinenberg, NYU sociologist and author of Going Solo, The Extraordinary Rise and Surprising Appeal of Living Alone, is here with two of his students, Jacob Faber, a doctoral student in sociology at NYU, and Liz Koslov, a doctoral student in media, culture, and communication at NYU. They've been looking at how the storm affected people beyond the shore dwellers, and what they found should inform the way we prepare for the next storm, they say. So welcome to all of you. And in your report, Jacob, it seems that Asians and Latinos in Queens bore a lot of the brunt of the storm impact, even though they didn't experience flooding all that much. Can you explain that?
Sure. So that is a very interesting point, that we look at Queens, which, less than the citywide average of the census tracts in that borough were flooded. But a large percentage of the city's Asian and Latino residents live. And when we say most impacted, we're thinking specifically about transit access. So Queens and Asian and Latino communities specifically in Queens saw the largest increase in average distance to the nearest subway stop when the MTA reopened the subways on November 1st.
And you looked at 311 calls. What did you learn there?
So the 311 calls were actually very, very interesting. So the week before Hurricane Sandy, 311 received around 4,000 calls. And the week after, it was almost 10 times that, 37,000 calls. Most of those calls were about building-related issues, electricity, sewer problems, and trees down. But what was most interesting about the call volume was that it persisted for such a long period of time. Calls and complaints and questions about building problems, sewers, electricity, things that people really need to, you know, have their lives whole, continued through most of December.
Among Asians and Latinos in Queens who didn't live near the shore. And Eric, as we know, the more vulnerable among us are still the most vulnerable among us when a disaster strikes. And they have a much harder time bouncing back. So when you look at Jacob's report that he was just describing, do you think the geography of the storm's impact is consistent with the region's geography of inequality?
It is, and Jacob's research as well as a report from the Furman Center at NYU has confirmed this, that lower-income people around New York City were disproportionately affected and displaced by the flooding. And, you know, Jacob's work is quite original. He was able to show that there are some neighborhoods in the city that are particularly prone to flooding and that also have very high concentrations of people who live alone and people who are poor, which helps us think about where we need to dedicate resources the next time there's a storm.
You wrote an article for The New Yorker a couple of months ago, and to me the takeaway was in this line that you wrote, quote, "The best techniques for safeguarding cities don't just mitigate disaster damage, they also strengthen the networks that promote health and prosperity during ordinary times." So are you saying instead of focusing so much on storm surge barriers and seawalls, we should be focusing maybe on getting people health insurance and higher paying jobs and stronger ties to the community, and that's not irrelevant?
Well, look, the social infrastructure really matters. It can make the difference between life and death in a disaster, and the way we build our neighborhoods and communities matters every day. So what I am afraid of as we deal with climate change is we'll respond to it the way we responded to September 11th and build this kind of architecture that tries to block things out. It may or may not work next time around, but it's certainly going to make our lives inconvenient and unpleasant every day. When we adapt to climate change, we have a chance to make ourselves safer from disasters by also improving conditions all the time. Let's look at those things.
Does this relate to your book about living alone, in which you really put forth a hypothesis that people living alone actually do have very strong social networks?
That's right. It does, because I think we fail to appreciate the ways in which our communities and our social lives protect us from all kinds of things. For instance, when we talk about climate change, we have a conversation about the weather. We have a conversation about seawalls or oyster beds or, you know, these kinds of things. And I think we also need to recognize that the first responders are the people who live in our neighborhoods. They are family members. Our capacity to communicate with each other is going to determine our outcome. And those things don't just spring up when there's a crisis. They're rooted in the way in which we live every day.
Now, Liz, you've been spending time on Staten Island.
Yeah.
And, you know, the waterfront is such an interesting slice of the city. It includes a lot of public housing, the Rockaways, the Lower East Side, Coney Island, but it also includes the gleaming tower dwellers along the Williamsburg, Greenpoint waterfront and Dumbo and Battery Park City and all that. So was this an equal opportunity storm? Did it affect the wealthier and not so wealthy residents alike if they did live on the shore?
Well, in Staten Island, it's very interesting because I think you have a lot of single-family homeowners there who hadn't really experienced the kind of vulnerability that they're now experiencing from the storm and feeling now very dependent on the government's decision whether or not to help them move or to help them rebuild. And they don't know yet whether or not they'll be able to stay. And on Staten Island, what's very interesting to me is that more than six neighborhoods, hundreds and hundreds of residents have organized together and collectively decided they want to move rather than rebuild.
And one of the most fraught questions, I think, since Sandy is, should we really be talking about managed retreat from the storm and from the shore, forgive me, in advance of future storms? And so have you come to a conclusion about whether that would be the most equitable thing to do? Does your time on Staten Island inform you about what people are thinking there?
That's certainly what the residents I've spoken to would like to see. And the plan that the state has proposed for buyouts of homes would turn lands in Fox Beach, for instance, which is part of Oakwood Beach in Staten Island, back into wetlands. And so it would provide this protective buffer that would protect against future storm surge. And a lot of residents, if they have to sell their homes and move, would rather see the land converted into space that would protect people further inland.
But you seem to be talking about people who are resigned to the possibility that they may, in fact, have to move. Where I could get the board to light up in a second with callers saying, this is my home, this is where my family has chosen to live, no government is going to tell me I'm not going to live by the shore.
Yeah, and that's what's been interesting to me about Staten Island is that they've had a lot of recurrent flooding, particularly in this part of Fox Beach, where after the storm, residents organized the Oakwood Beach Buyout Committee, and nearly 200 of them decided, we do want to move. And I think they continue to feel very at risk from recurrent flooding and don't feel safe living there any longer.
And we should say that both the city and the state of New York have proposed buyouts of people who own property along the shore. But the state wants to buy the land and keep it vacant, like create those wetland barriers, while the city, Eric, is proposing buying land and building back better, which I think probably means developers swooping in and building in very well-defended, more luxury homes. Is that right?
There are some key distinctions between the city plan and the state plan. That is certainly one of them. The other is that there are different proposals for the rate of the buyback, with the state proposing to buy people out whole at the pre-storm value, and much of the city's planning proposes buying people out at the current value. I think what Liz is turning up in her research, which is really important and original, is that a lot of the homeowners feel willing to move and to retreat from the coast if they think it's going to be a good thing for the city and to make this a safer place. It feels, on the other hand, terrible to them to think that they would move away and give up this special place that they've made their community on just so a wealthy developer can come and build condos for wealthy people. It's a real political issue.
So, Jacob, in your report on the mostly Asian and Latino populations of inner Queens who are very affected by Sandy, even though they don't live near the shore, do you come to some policy recommendations?
Yeah, so I think first and foremost is the social infrastructure piece that Eric so eloquently brought up that I couldn't expand upon. There are also physical infrastructure improvements that almost certainly need to be made. So the subways is a clear place to start. Electricity infrastructure, the grid needs to be crucial parts of the grid need to be moved out of flood-prone areas. We know the story about boilers and basements. Housing infrastructure needs to be built more resiliently in a lot of places that are flood-prone. But in addition to physical and social infrastructure, you know, it's the academic's prerogative to say there needs to be more research on how recovery is happening across populations and neighborhoods.
Well, very interesting stuff. especially for school. You know, you just blew the stereotype of, oh, all they do is hang out and drink and waste their parents' money.
Well, look, I do want to say about this that, what we do well in the university world is this kind of research and teaching. And in this, the moment that Sandy went away, that we got our power back, we started convening faculty and graduate students at NYU through the Institute of Public Knowledge and holding this course on how we should think about pro-building New York City now that we live in this age of extremes. And the research that Liz and Jacob and their colleagues at NYU are doing now is really exciting, and I do hope it has real impact.
What would you tell the mayor or governor, by the way, just in 30 seconds? Because I don't hear Mayor Bloomberg or Governor Cuomo talking about, creating strong social ties as a way to prepare for the next big storm.
Well, I've been very vocal on this issue. I mean, it seems to me that it's crucial and that we really need to think about how communities are defining their own needs and vulnerabilities, the kinds of problems that they can articulate and the solutions that they have. We need to hear those as we deal with this question of how we will spend the tens of billions of dollars in federal relief that will come to New York City. We can't have a top-down solution that doesn't take into consideration what our communities know they need.
NYU sociologist Eric Kleinenberg, grad students Jacob Faber and Liz Kosloff. Great work. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And coming up next, none other than Stephen Dubner from Freakonomics with a modest proposal, ban tipping. And he also has some number-crunching conclusions about tipping and race. Stay with us.